interview, which I must admit I'm very excited about, with Deacon Dave, who's spent quite some time in Iraq while the war was on earlier on this year, and our friend Steve is going to be interviewing him later on. What else have we got going on this evening? We've also got more music. We've got some reports from a direct action that took place in Cheshire that some Sheffield people went on to. We've got some words from Manu Chao, who some of you may be aware of. What we're going to go for first, though, is a track from Rob Johnson, who's... which is going to introduce this thing, this interview with Deacon Dave. We're just queuing it up now, and we'll have some... Well, those of you who know Rob Johnson will know that he's local and very big in the anti-war movement. We've got a track coming up from him in just a second. Here we go.
I keep seeing us everywhere, as far as the eye can see. It's like this river overflowing. We got Muslims, we got Christians, we got pagans, we got Jews, we got atheists, anarchists, socialists. We even got a liberal or two on the day. We all said stop the war on the day. We all said stop the war. We got t-shirts, we got keffiyehs, hijabs and rainbow scarves. We got placards that say we're angry. We got placards that make you laugh. We got whistles, badges, banners, 10,000 djembes and a salsa band. We got pensioners, we got pushchairs, arm in arm and hand in hand. On the day we all said stop the war. On the day we all said stop the war. We got the actress and the bishop. We got tankies, we got trucks. And some got extra sandwiches in case their mates forgot. We got respectable housewives from suburbia who've never done this sort of thing before. With the international sex workers of the world united, and the girl and the boy next door. On the day we all said stop the war. On the day we all said stop the war. We got that what's her name from off of the telly. We got that bloke I met called Steve. But we are more than just 2 million. We are Ramallah and Tel Aviv. We are New York, Paris, Berlin, Moscow, Cape Town, Cairo, Bangkok to Glasgow. We are this river overflowing. On the day we all said stop the war. On the day we all said stop the war. On the day we all said stop the war. On the day we all said stop the war. Stop the war. I keep seeing us everywhere.
Right, that was Rob Johnson with The Day We All Said Stop the War. This is Bill here. I'm just saying hello to some people who we hope are listening. Philip Bechamp in Montreal, Canada. He should be tuning in. Actually, we'll have to monitor the chat room as well to see if anybody's talking to us there. Maybe some people from IMC Radio in London. Dave of Planet Mail, Chris Corrupt Youth, and Sean, I hope, are tuning in. Also from Sheffield, Chris, who's back from his holidays in Malta. And there's a shout out there for you. Right, now we're going over to Steve, who is interviewing Deacon Dave, who was recently in Iraq during the conflict. So over to Steve and Dave.
Okay, hi everybody, my name's Steve. I'm here tonight with Deacon Dave, who's a Nether Edge resident. He was very active in the Nether Edge Against the War group, and just before the war started, he went out to Baghdad, spent a week in Baghdad. I'm going to be talking to him about his trip. He's also he's going to be giving a slideshow and a talk in 2 days' time on Thursday at the Hartley Street Project in Healy at 7:30. That's on Hartley Street. And there's also going to be a film there about the human shields in Baghdad. So that's on Thursday at 7:30. Okay, Dave.
Hi.
Hello. Hi. What made you decide to go out to Iraq?
I was inspired when I saw the human shields leaving from London in their double-decker buses. I think because I'd been feeling a lot of frustration, I was feeling a lot of compassion for the Iraqi people. They just seemed to be caught between a brutal regime and sanctions, which has been going on for 12 years, and now they were being threatened with an invasion. And my heart just went out to them as people, and I thought, well, what can we do? And then when I saw the human shields go, I thought, yeah, that would be a good thing to do, to go there and show some solidarity with them.
And when you left, did you know that the war would likely be started when you were actually out there?
Well, yes. We weren't sure. When I was planning to go, we were hoping that we could get there ahead of time and actually stop the war. Obviously, that was what you know, millions of us around the country were hoping for. As it came, by the time I caught a plane, it was fairly obvious that it was unstoppable by that point. But I got to Amman before the actual conflict broke out, but we got stopped getting visas. We had all kinds of bureaucratic nightmares. So, in fact, the bombing had started by the time we set off down the road to Baghdad.
Right, and how did you feel about that? It must have been quite scary going out, knowing there's this, you know, huge plan of dropping 3,000... sort of guided missiles and God knows how many other missiles.
It was scary. We talked about it a lot as a group, whether this was really what we wanted to do, because there was 10 of us together and we had a week in Amman to think about this one. But we were all convinced that this was the right thing to do. And we thought that the risk was okay. It wasn't a totally stupid risk. We knew that a lot of cars were still getting through on that road. There was there were a certain number that were getting hit and burnt out, but the vast majority were getting through. So we kind of thought, yeah, it's an important thing to do. At this time, the Iraqi people need our support. They need solidarity, and it's worth the risk.
And what was your first impressions when you went to Iraq? I presume that's your first ever visit there.
It is. The first thing was just how welcoming everybody was. I mean, as soon as we started to meet Iraqis, we met the US troops first on the road, and they weren't too welcoming. But past that, once we got into the Iraqi checkpoints, obviously they were very worried about us when they saw us. You know, most of our team were from the United States, and so they're saying, you've got two busloads of Americans heading into Baghdad. You know, but once we'd explained what we were doing, that we were there with the Christian peacemaker teams, our role was to try and defuse conflict and to stand in solidarity with the people who are suffering at this time, and then they were totally all over us. Welcome to the country, thank you for coming, you know, do come in.
Did you have any problems with sort of translation? I presume, do you have your own translator with
we
you?
Had people with us who could translate, and once we were in Baghdad, we had government minders that wouldn't let us go anywhere without them, so, and they were also able to translate for us.
And what did you do? You were there for 1 week. The bombs were presumably raining down. What were you doing?
We were visiting hospitals and bomb sites mainly. Previous to that, because the Voices have had a team in there since 1996, and Christian Peacemakers have been there since October. So previous to that, they'd been visiting schools and families and government officials and all that kind of stuff. And that wasn't so possible under the present circumstances. But we found that there was a lot of, we were able to take eyewitness accounts from a lot of people, get the story on some of the possible war crimes that were happening. We were at that, while I was there, we were still able to get photographs out to the media and out to our supporters around the world, and make sure that people knew the story, or stories of what Iraqi people were going through.
Are those particular stories that stand out that you sort of like to tell us about? Or?
I think the one house that we went to was just a young boy that I met there, and he was just in the midst of all this, like his family was critically ill in hospital, and his cousin had broken legs, and the house was just trashed. And yet he was just beaming. He was just so excited to have all these foreigners coming around and camera crews and all this kind of stuff. And I think that, for me, was everywhere we went, we met children like that. They were still playing football while the bombs were dropping out on the streets. And I think I was just so struck with the courage and the resilience of the Iraqi people in the face of all that they've gone through. They still keep smiling and laughing and enjoying life.
Right. And how about the bombing? You're saying these kids are sort of out there playing in the streets where the bombs are dropping. Did any bombs drop particularly close to you? Was that?
No, it's remarkable how quickly one adjusts to these things. That once you're actually there, most of it was quite localized, and they were hitting the palaces and the government ministries, and it was all on the other side of the river. So when we were driving around, we could see where the places were that were being hit, but none of it was very close to us. And after a few days, we were moved into a hotel which was right next to the Hotel Palestine, and that seemed to me that was a pretty safe place to be. As it happened, of course, a couple of days after I left, the journalists were killed there.
Right. Okay. And have you got any recent updates from the Christian Peacemaker team or Voices in the Wilderness about what they're doing out there now?
Yeah, in the immediate aftermath of the invasion, they were trying to liaise with the US troops and not having a lot of success, trying to get them to clean up the munitions that were scattered all over the city, and they organised a campaign in the States to get people to send orange tape to their senators, because the soldiers kept saying, "Oh, we don't have the equipment to even tape off the dangerous areas," and that has improved over the a couple of weeks later. They have started to pick that stuff up. The situation is not good, and people are getting increasingly angry as each day goes by, and they haven't got jobs, they haven't got water, they haven't got electricity, and so I don't, it's not looking like a hopeful situation. There's nothing that looks like it's going to improve in the short term in Iraq at this time. People are still dying. There's still shootings going on. It's a much worse situation now than it was under Saddam Hussein.
Great. Okay, thanks very much for that, Dave. If you want to hear more about Dave's tour, see his slides and see the film about the human shields, it's on Thursday night at 7:30 at the Hartley Street Project in Healy. Okay.
Hi, we're back to Paul. I mentioned right at the top of the show that there's a good chance that the Buddhist Punk is going to come and see us next week and talk about what he's been doing around the war and whatever. Just to tell you a little bit about him, he's been performing poetry and spoken word in and around Sheffield for about a year and a half now. You may have seen him at a number of benefit gigs. I know he played the anti-war gig at the Corporation earlier on in the year. He's played at the Cow's Bar and at Bukowski's. So, and there's going to be gigs all over. He's playing at the Shambhala Festival in August, and he's currently putting together a book of his writings, and it's called The Subverse Meditations of a Buddhist Punk. So we'll be interviewing Tim next week, and just to give you a short sample, here's a poem of his called Emotional Motion.
Keep moving, words, keep moving. I'm trying to find some peace, trying to locate the source of love and some form of release. Keep moving, words, keep moving on, towards emancipation, where freedom is found in a moment of calm and the loss of deliberation. Keep moving, words, keep shouting, voice, keep telling the people they have a choice, that the world isn't built by a chosen few, but by all of us together and by everything we do. Keep moving our minds to a place so free that we can simply let each other be. Keep steadfast, heart, in the fervent fog of fundamentalist pollution. Keep growing in strength, keep growing in faith. This is emotional evolution. Keep moving on, because there's always more room, and it's love that made the Big Bang go boom. Keep moving, feet, keep moving, hands. I keep my eyes wide open and observe the delicate strands. Keep moving, people, keep meeting one another. Keep making friends, not enemies. Treat stranger as sister and brother. Keep shaping minds by moving slow and upon the meditation flow. Keep moving ink, keep moving pen, as the process of change is captured again. Keep moving then, and keep moving more. Together we'll find a whole new door. Keep opening the door and open it wide. We'll allow all the races to step inside. Keep moving then, with a limp and a hop. I guarantee we'll get there. We have no choice. The secret will out, and the penny will finally drop. Keep moving, in a natural way, from birth through life into death. Keep filling lungs with oxygen, keep moving air and catching your breath. Keep moving life, and keep moving zen. Keep calm amongst the chaos, as the process starts all over again. Keep moving on, in this constant revolution, bound as we are by the lifeline illusion. It's bound to cause hysteria and some form of shared confusion when the circle of life is the key, but the centre of self, the solution.
We're going to have more from Tim, as we said. If we have time, we might fit another little poem in just before the end, all being well. We've now come to the part of the show where we're going to tell you about some of the things that are going on in and around Sheffield over the coming weeks. What we'd like to do is to big up some stuff that's happening this coming weekend. On Saturday, if you're round and about in the Netherthorpe, Upperthorpe area, there's a festival at the Ponderosa grounds, what used to be called Philadelphia in the old days, for those who can remember back that far. Lots of community activities. It's billed as a multicultural festival, so I dare say you'll be able to find fantastic food, a variety of music. I know that the Sheffield Samba Band are running a workshop there on Saturday afternoon. So plenty for all the family to do, and another good example of something that's grown out of people doing it for themselves. The original Ponderosa Festival was just a group of people in Upperthorpe who said, nothing goes wrong on round here, we need something to happen, and they organised it themselves. Another good example of that is something that's happening on Sunday this week. The Abbeyfield Multicultural Festival, a well-established festival in Sheffield, takes place this Sunday afternoon starting at 1 o'clock at Abbeyfield Park, which is on Burngreave Road in Pitsmoor. Lots and lots going on there. Again, the Samba Band are going to be there. They're on a tour this weekend, I suspect. Again, lots of food, lots of music, Sheffield Park Rangers, all kinds of stuff going on. We'll look forward to seeing you there. I'll certainly be there. Handing you over to Bill for another couple of notices.
Okay, well, while we're here, we should big up our friends in London at Indie Media London and their weekly show, which is on the best radio station in the world. That is Resonance FM on 104.4 FM in the London area, and webcasting on the internet via the Community Media Association's streaming server, and also DeckSpace's server as well. So 1 p.m. till 2 p.m. tomorrow. My next item here is Sheffield Indie Media Presents Section OS at the Showroom Cinema on July the 26th at 4 o'clock. This feature-length documentary charts the growth of Linux, the operating system for computers that was born out of rebellion. The pioneers of Linux, and it is Linux, not Linux, were disgusted at the growth of proprietary software in the late 70s. It's more than just an operating system, it's an opportunity to stand against the large corporations and their exclusive rights to software, who charge others unfairly for using them. The hackers wanted to create something new that was free to all and depended on the communities using it to make it grow. Tickets are £3 full price, £2 concessions, and that's July the 26th at Sheffield Showroom Cinema at 4 o'clock.
And me and the rest of the geeks will be there as well. Okay, last thing I want to mention is, well, we mentioned last week that Sheryl Festival, the big event, was happening in the park on Saturday, and those of you who went, like I did, will have had a great day. It was lovely and sunny, fantastic music, big, big variety of music. I ate some of the best food I've eaten all year and generally had a really lovely day. But the thing to say about it all is that Sharrow Festival isn't just a one-day event. It's happening all round Sharrow up to the 20th of July. So last week we mentioned things like activities in schools, workshops, even a special Sharrow pizza, I understand. Now, I've not made my way up to Sharrow to pull one in, but I think I might be doing over the next week or so. If you have any events that you'd like to let us know about, please do go to our website. IndieMedia is primarily a website, so you can always visit us at www.indiemedia.org.uk and follow the Sheffield links. And we'd be very happy for you to put some stuff up on there about what's going on in your area, your community, and what happens to you. Okay, we're now going to... I'm going to hand over to Bill again, who's going to do a little bit of an introduction about a geezer called Manu Chao.
Before I'm going to do that, slight hiccup there. I've still got some other What's On stuff. We've got the Electro Bloom Mini Festival, which is a night dedicated to parting the electronic fringe, as they say, promising new synth, retro, electro, experimental performance soundtracks. And artists for the night are New Vogue, doing some postmodern synth pop, Wunderlich and his extraordinary evocation with new and original material of the tragic chanteuse Nico, 42 Hertz playing with the raw components of silence, and the uber glamorati, I think they call themselves, Ralph and the Ralphettes, doing some glamatronica. And that is down at the Grapes, Trippet Lane, Thursday, 17th of July, 8 p.m, £3 on the door. Busy night in Sheffield, actually, on Thursday, because on the same night is Sandman Magazine in conjunction with Bock Studios. They've got a night down at Bed, the nightclub, for those of you who don't live in Sheffield. And they've got Top Video Fiddlers Media Lounge kicking the night off from 9 p.m. followed by live sets from Deck Geezer Gadget Boy and Laptop Genius Feedle, nicely rounded up by eclectic and far-thinking DJs Ed Nowen and Urban Gorillas Maley. So that's Bed, London Road, Sheffield, £5, 9 p.m. till 2 a.m.
House, drum and bass, UK underground, breaks, techno, R&B. This is Sheffield Live Night. Call our presenters now at 0114 281 4092. Sheffield Live, 106.6 FM.
Right, so yeah, I've got an interview here, recorded by Radio Earth Summit last year when Manu Chao was in the country. I was fortunate enough to actually go to his gig in Manchester. Tickets were £10 and I bought my ticket for £30 off a tout outside, so that's capitalism red in tooth and claw for you. Manu Chao is a musician and superstar in many parts of the world. He's also an anti-globalisation hero. He travels the world with his band, the Radio Bemba Sound System, meeting with resistance movements all over the world. This interview, as I say, was recorded last year when Radio Earth Summit met up with him at 1 a.m. after a gig in Brixton Academy. So he's quite well lubricated, shall we say. Very funny interview. Clear, strong ideas. So we will try and bring that in now.
Hello, I'm Manu from Radio Bemba. This is the sound for everybody down there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hello, hello, hello. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Hello, hello, hello. That's it.
And why that sound?
Because I'm drunk and happy. I'm drunk and happy because I forgot 5 minutes and this world is terrible, is no good. When I look to the world with lucidity, when I'm not drunk and happy, I feel very sad because everything's going bad. And it makes me very sad, but it makes me strong because we have to fight. We have to change that. It's our only opportunity. If you feel resignated, you're dead. The only solution is to fight and to try to change things because this world is very sick, because money is very powerful and money is the big devil of this planet. They kill everything with money. So we need to fight against that.
And when you travel around the world and you meet different communities who've been affected by multinational corporations, what concerns you most?
The situation is terrible everywhere. I'm a lucky person. I can travel around the world, so I can see different cultures. And nowhere I go, things are going good. There's a terrible situation for lot of people, and for the nature also. For the nature, the situation is emergency. It's everywhere. The problem is everywhere. I never found a place in my life in this world where things going good. Always this kind of dictature of money. I don't want this future for my children. I have to fight. I have to change things because I want to have a lot of children. So I want a nice future for them. What they try to impose to me, actually, is a bad future for my children. I don't want.
And you've stayed with lots of resistant movements around the world, like the Zapatistas, Movimiento Sem Terra, the Landless Movement in Brazil, and people who are fighting against water privatization in Bolivia. Can you tell me a bit about those movements and what it felt like being with them?
Everywhere you travel, you see a lot of disasters. But everywhere you travel, you see and you meet people that try to fight against these disasters. And you meet everywhere what I call hope. That's hope, that's esperanza. People try to change things. It's time. It's a kind of race between the sickness and the irresponsibility of money and the sense of humanity of people. We have to be all united. We don't all think the same in this kind of moments, but we must be all united. That's the more important thing, actually.
And do you think that the media paints the full picture?
The media is something, but also really what is important is your own neighborhood. The first fight is in your own neighborhood. The first fight is with yourself. The first fight is won, is to be yourself a good person. It's already a strong fight. After your family can, you can change things in your family. And after you can change things in your neighborhood. Everybody can do that. Not just famous people. Everybody can change things in his neighborhood. I believe in million and million and million of revolutions of little neighborhoods.
That's actually one of Friends of the Earth slogans, is think globally, act locally.
I like it. I believe in that, yes. It's a good slogan. Exactly. That's what I try to do. Exactly.
And also Friends of the Earth International at the Earth Summit in August are calling for international rules to control big business. Do you support a call for rules to control big business?
Big business is mafia, and mafia is dictature. And dictature is very hard to fight against dictature, because we're living in a dictature of money. And more behind democracy is hidden mafia. That's the, we got to fight against mafia. Mafia, they are the danger. They hide behind democracy. They're all mafia, mafia. They are very dangerous. It's dictature. We have to fight against these people. They don't think about the future. They just think about money.
Manu Chao interviewed after an interview, interviewed after a gig last year. Last week, we spent about 10 minutes talking to some members of the Trolleyed Collective who went to Avian. I had the good fortune to speak to a couple of people who also went there with a slightly different perspective and a different set of stories and other things for us to learn. We had such a good conversation that we're actually going to split this interview into two halves. They had such interesting things to say. We're going to do half this week and half next week. So this is an interview with Nick and Helen, who also went to Avian at the beginning of June. Okay, like to talk to Nick and Helen, who were two other people who went to Avian. So I'll ask you the same question that I asked Trolleyed last week. What were your motivations for going?
I mean, essentially, our disagreement that we share with lots of people around the world about the legitimacy of the G8 and their agenda, and through their unified agenda of these sort of the elites' industrial nations, the economic policy and social policies that they're trying to dictate to the rest of the world, and what that means to us as individuals in our own communities, trying to survive our lives. But also, I think, always find it particularly inspiring to connect with other activists and come together on these international demonstrations for that huge sense of solidarity and that sense of, you know, working together across borders and from people around the world in sort of trying to shut down the G8. Essentially, we weren't there to protest. We were there to more than express our disagreement. We were there to shut it down, and we wanted to be part of that.
Yeah, that's an important part, the direct action against the, you know, as we say, it's an illegal gathering, and that's a very important aspect, that, you know, our specific aims were to close it down rather than just protest. I think we achieved it to an extent, particularly on the first day, but on the whole it is very inspiring to see such a large international gathering of people creating space to allow us to have a voice and a response to what we do see as a cabal of industrialised elites that are creating an agenda for them to take, particularly to take to the World Trade Order, and have a unified action on their part to place their agenda on the world. So that is a large, important part.
So, you arrived in France. I understand that you stayed at the same village as Trolleyed, the Vargues village, the anti-war and anti-authoritarian village.
Yeah.
And they talked quite a lot last week about the way that the village worked in terms of democratic structures, very horizontal nature of what was going on. Did you find that as well? Was that your experience as well?
It was. It was very inspiring in the way that it was organised and how there was space to sort of explore political ideas and act them out for the first time, not often something we get to do, and explore that among ourselves. And I think it worked quite well. You could get involved to the degree that you wanted to around the sort of collective meetings and the way it was all organised around the sort of the kitchens and the meetings that we had. But also, just the amazing part as well was the infrastructure that these people had gathered together. The kitchens, the events, the sort of like mini conferences, just the actual nature of the place and what people brought to it was pretty inspiring.
Yeah, the attempt that they made to pull themselves away from any organised authoritarian dictatorial methods was one of the most inspiring parts. It was an open platform for people to voice their opinions, and I think what was particularly inspiring was the last day where the village invited the villagers to come to an open meeting and a dinner. And I think that was very inspiring because the media had hyped up, had scaremongered the locals, and they were very scared of who and what we were. Thought we were just a bunch of unorganised vagabond criminals who were going to smash everything up. And it was inspiring because the villagers came up and they were asked to speak. And before, they had quite a few of them had been to political meetings, but they were dictated to and not asked to voice their own opinions. And I think that was a very inspiring thing. And I think we can see that all around the world. It's slowly we're able to get away from being told what we are and being asked what we are. And I think that's a very inspiring part of it, and that is something that I have brought back.
Also, it provided a space for them to begin to understand us, because very often our voice and our ideas doesn't clearly reach them. And we had a general meeting where everybody could stand up and express, and they were asking them us questions about who we were, and it gave us a chance to explain what our dreams and ideas were, and just to, you know, really like hands across this huge divide. And it was such a wonderful evening, and of sort of music and food and discourse that doesn't usually take place. We're so divided by how we're represented in the media, and I think it was one of the big successes of what Varg did, was to establish that link with the local community while we were staying there.
I think something that really knocked it on the head was an activist from Ireland at the meeting stated that he had travelled a long way to come to this demonstration, but it was nowhere near as far as the villagers had come to meet us at the camp on that day. And I think that just expressed it so beautifully, that these people really had come far to come and meet us, hopefully to destroy the myths that had been spread about us and open up a dialogue.
I'd like to talk a little bit about what actually happened to you while you were there in terms of the actions that you were specifically involved with. You mentioned that your intention was to go to Geneva. We talked with Trollid last week, and they did most of their activity around the camp and also around Lausanne. Did you get to Geneva? And if so, what happened to you while you were there?
Yes, the first day of actions was on the Friday, and we went to Geneva from En Masse, which is actually a French suburb of Geneva. We had to cross the border, which we did illegally. 300 of us got on a train from En Masse to Geneva to take part in the demonstration. We actually commandeered the train and refused to pay and crossed the border illegally without showing any identification. And before we arrived at Geneva train station, we were aware that there was a presence of riot police there waiting for us. So we actually pulled the emergency cord on the train and departed the train before it got into the station, and therefore we were able to move through Geneva without a police presence, which was particularly strange, seeing us 300 of us marching down the streets of a normal everyday Geneva suburb heading towards a demonstration. The locals seemed a bit...
But guided by locals.
Yeah, absolutely, we were guided by locals. I think the atmosphere was particularly interesting because we'd previously been to Genoa, and the police repression from day one there was absolutely phenomenal. You were scared to go out on the streets, people were getting picked up, dragged to police stations, and so we were particularly aware of that situation. We didn't know what the police response was going to be, so that was first and foremost in our heads. But as we arrived at the demonstration, there was a loud sound system playing which seemed like Germanic rock music, which was particularly bizarre, but it was a blazing hot day, and it turned out to be a fairly decent-sized demonstration. And we then proceeded to commit ourselves to a tour of several institutions within Geneva that we decided we wanted to vent our fury against opposition to.
Give us an example of some of the places that you visited in Geneva.
The WTO headquarters was obviously something everybody made a beeline for, and was on one of the first stops on our what turned out to be almost like a radical tourist trip of been sort of showed around the institutions, and people with the sound system gave a bit of a sort of overview of the sort of criminal activity of each institution as we passed it. But we got to the WTO, there was really no police around, and as Nick was saying, it was kind of sort of slightly disarming us because we weren't used to such a low police presence, so people weren't really sure what they could do. But eventually people started attacking the signs, there was graffiti going up everywhere, people managed to break the locks on the gates swung open, but unfortunately that revealed a line of well-armed riot police, so there was a bit of a standoff, and that was really it for the day. It was kind of like going so far in the graffiti and challenging the infrastructure around us as we could, but there was still this sort of like final line of police. So it was a bit of a strange day, really, that we were left alone, but people weren't really sure how far they could take it. But a little bit of tear gas that day, but really we were left to it. I think it was the police testing out to see how the rest of the days were going to unfold. But it was very much like a radical tourist trip. It would have suited open top buses, really.
With proper open with proper public transport that you don't have to pay for in the first place.
This is
Sheffield Indie Media
on Sheffield Live 106.6 FM, on the web at sheffield.indiemedia.org.uk.
Okay, and you listen to Christina here on the Indie Media Radio Show on Sheffield Live FM. And that was the first part of Nick and Helen's interview. The second part will be, you'll be able to listen next week. And that was very interesting indeed. And we've got another guest here in the studio with us that was in Evian as well. Hello, Adam.
Hi.
So you were in Geneva actually as well, as Nick and Helen were.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So, What kind of how did the sequence of events go?
Well, we set off on the Friday evening, and we arrived on the Saturday. We had to pass through France, and in the when we crossed from Calais from Dover to Calais, and when we got to the border check at Calais, the security people kept us waiting for about an hour, and there was actually a military presence there as well, and they took all our passports off us. This is the first thing that we realised the extent of the political oppression that's going on there. They basically took our passports off us and made us sit in the coach for about an hour, and they went through everyone's passports and obviously a thorough check on everything that was going there. And then we drove through France overnight and arrived in Geneva on Saturday morning.
Right. So was there any demonstrations on that day that you took part in, or
on Saturday? There was nothing on Saturday. There was a lot of partying going on Saturday, and the first thing that really kicked off was there was like a minor riot in Geneva on the Saturday evening, and that, I think it was just a very small fringe of people who took it upon themselves to start smashing up corporate symbols like banks and that kind of thing. We heard that going off in the city, and we actually saw a lot of riot police with CS gas canisters attached to their backs and things like that, and I think there were a few arrests made, but that was the only thing. Unfortunately, the media decided like to focus on that entirely, and managed to completely neglect the huge demonstration that also went on the Sunday.
And were you there for that, yeah?
What was
the Sunday demonstration like?
The Sunday demonstration, I mean, it was amazing. It was the first international demonstration I've been on, and I was on the Stop the War demonstration in London, as I'm sure half the UK were as well. The G8 demonstration it blew me away in terms of the sheer volume of people, and the diversity of the people. There's so many different. There's just every nationality you can imagine there. So.
Right, and so you say this was the first international demonstration you went to, and kind of what was the reason behind? What made you attend this gathering?
Because myself and lots and lots of other people feel very strongly about what's going on in the world today. It sounds probably quite corny, but you know, I genuinely do, and you know, I think you know, I mean, I made a decision recently just to get more involved in what's going on in the world, and to start actually attending demonstrations, and you know, lending my presence to these things. Yeah.
I definitely know what you mean there. And so Nick and Helen and Trollied as well, that we interviewed last week, they all had really positive feelings. They all mentioned feelings of empowerment and of it all overall being something very positive for themselves and coming back with loads of new ideas and very inspired. How are your feelings?
Well, it was certainly very empowering. As I say, whilst it was empowering, and it certainly did feel empowering to see that many people all marching in solidarity and you know, with a common cause, that was certainly very empowering. I also found it quite disturbing the fact that the media managed to entirely overlook the entire demonstration on the Sunday, in which I actually climbed to the top of a building and you could see a wave upon wave of people like stretching each way to the horizon. We crossed through the border to Evian, and I found it disturbing the media focused on literally a handful of so-called anarchists who decided to cause mayhem and destruction. Did the cause no favours whatsoever?
Right. See, so you feel you're going to take part in something similar again?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Great stuff. Okay, thank you very much, Adam. We're
no
going
problem.
To continue. Yeah,
thanks.
Cheers for coming down.
Bye.
We're going to continue now.
Yeah, we're going to continue with a recording of Noam Chomsky talking about weapons of mass destruction. It's a bit of audio that we found on the internet, so that's all I can say about it for the moment. Let's see if this works.
Well, without proceeding, it's plain that there cannot have been any moral or humanitarian motive behind anything that's going on. And it certainly cannot possibly have been the official motives, the ones that are reported by, say, the Boston Globe editors. It cannot be Saddam's crimes that are motivating this. That, again, is just elementary logic. What about the threat of weapons of mass destruction? Well, that's, there's a number of problems. Suppose we're concerned about weapons of mass destruction. Then one question, obviously, is how come it wasn't true in 1988, when it was a much more serious threat than it is today? Little question. Second question is, the latest bombings, for example, are part of the justification is that they were supposed to reduce Saddam's capacity to produce weapons of mass destruction, but it was conceded at once, in advance, in fact, that the bombings would have the opposite effect. They would increase that capacity. That was conceded because it was obvious. The major effect of the bombing would be to eliminate UNSCOM, you know, the UNSCOM inspections. In fact, at least if you can believe Scott Ritter, one of the chief inspectors who resigned from UNSCOM about a year ago, the U.S. had already undermined UNSCOM by turning it into a spy agency, which essentially destroyed it. He said, so I quit. But whether he's right or not about that, probably is, in December, the bombing was, it was understood in advance and stated that, yes, this will eliminate and make it extremely hard for UNSCOM to continue its mission. And the inspection mission is regime is the only thing that has cut back weapons. And it's been pretty successful, in fact, quite successful, and could remain so. But, of course, once that's broken, it's not going to happen. If you look at the official war aims last December, they made it pretty clear. They said the official aim is to degrade Saddam's weapons capacity. And as a number of people noticed, that means they had no war aim at all. Because, you know, you shoot one bullet at a door and you degrade the capacity. It's meaningless. There were no credible war aims. In fact, the effect of the bombing could only be to increase the alleged danger. Probably will be that. But what's interesting is it doesn't matter. I mean, the fact that there are no credible war aims and that the standard reason doesn't even rise to the level of a joke doesn't matter at all. It's still a just attack, and we must march in a parade, right? In other words, we must act as if we're in a totalitarian society, following orders, marching in a parade, even though we recognize that the marching orders are idiotic and would collapse under 30 seconds of inquiry, and that the motive for this last attack is that, you know, that the effect of it will be the opposite of what's claimed. Despite knowing all of that, we must march in a parade. If you're an educated, responsible citizen, kind of folks who walk around places like this, that's the way you're supposed to behave. Well, you know, it tells us something about the expectations for us and about the values that are internalized by educated people, because, you know, they're not getting orders to do this. They just do it naturally.
106.6 FM Sheffield Live, bringing you live coverage of the 2003 Sharrow Festival, including music, discussion and community initiatives.
106.6 FM.
Also, in collaboration with internationally renowned sports complex Ponds Forge, we will be giving away free access all area day passes, their luxury jacuzzi, spa, gym and extensive fitness classes. Just listen to Breakfast tomorrow morning from 8 with CK and Princess Danny, exclusive to 106.6 FM Sheffield Live. 106.6 FM Sheffield Live, your station for the summer of 2003.
Welcome back to Sheffield Live. immediately after us, it's not really like us, but we're quite looking forward to it, because immediately on after us is the Steel City Hip Hop Show. And tonight that's done by Mr. Joe, Jay Blends and Danny B. And tonight they've got a special guest, Multiverse 3. So I'll be listening after we finish here. Hope you will be too. We'll look forward to that in about 10 minutes. Which means we're running hideously behind schedule. So what I'd like to do now is to have a quick conversation with Christina and Steve. You've heard quite a bit of them this evening, but they've had a busy week really. Last Thursday you were over in Cheshire. At a building company. What on earth were you doing there?
We were taking part in a little action that happened by a Manchester group against AMEC, actually, who's building a very dodgy, I might say, pipeline, oil pipeline in Turkey, Azerbaijan and Georgia. It goes through, actually, those three countries.
The Baku Siam pipeline it basically takes oil and gas from the Caspian Sea region out to Turkey. It's for use primarily by the United States and Western Europe. I personally went there because global warming sort of issues. I know that, you know, we're already releasing far too much CO2 into the atmosphere, and a pipeline that's going to transport this huge amount of new oil into the sort of Bush regime, which sort of say they want to build more power stations that have no interest in global warming at all. I think it needs to be opposed. But since I went there, I found out about a whole load of other things about this pipeline, which make it particularly, dodgy is the word, yeah.
We must say here that the BP, British Petroleum, is actually leading the consortium of companies, and AMEC is the one that's actually building the pipelines. And some interesting facts about what the pipeline is actually going to be pumping out, so to say. So it's going to transport 365 million barrels of oil and 730 million cubic meters of gas each year, which in effect will produce 177 million tons of carbon dioxide, which is more than the pollution from every power station in the UK. And also it's overall 2.5 times the emissions that the UK should be cutting down on under the Kyoto Protocol Agreement. So all in all, a very devastating environmentally and also socially and like human rights kind of issues are coming in there as well. So overall, very devastating.
Yeah, and it's not just global pollution. I mean, that's going to be the longest lasting impact of the pipeline. But in the short term, the pipeline's planned to last for 40 years. And this is running through an area which is known for its earthquakes. Since 1924, there have been 17 major earthquakes. I mean, these are big earthquakes, up to 7.9 on the Richter scale. In 1939, there was an earthquake that killed 33,000 people. So over the next 40 years, there's very likely to be a major earthquake. BP say they're going to run it at angles to them, and these actual earthquakes are actually on the right on the site of where the pipeline is going to go. It's not just the region, these are actually on the site. If you look wider, there's even more earthquakes. BP say that they can cope with this by running the pipeline across the faults, but in fact a lot of the pipeline is actually underground in Turkey, so that doesn't really add up.
Okay, we are running short of time. If you want to read more about that particular campaign, it does appear on our Sheffield Newswire on our website, and we've given you instructions how to get there loads of times, so you should, if you don't know, you should have been paying attention. There's lots more information on there and links to also some Mark Thomas writings on this particular pipeline. We've got some more Newswire stuff that we'd like to truck through really, really quickly. Also on an environmental tip, I just need to grab the piece of paper. Hang on, be back to you in a second. There's a fairly catastrophic scheme been dreamt up to build a road through one of the most beautiful bits of the Peak District. This is a Mottram Tintwistle bypass, part of the new M6, M1 cross Pennine link. It's going to go between the A57, which is the Snake, if you know that, and the A628, which is Woodhead bypass. We've got till the 21st of July to make our presence felt there to say we really don't need any more roads in Derbyshire. Thank you very much. If you want more information on that particular campaign, go to www.roadalert.org.uk. Over to Christina.
Yes, and an update on the International Day of Action for Thessalonica prisoners, a bit on which we mentioned like on the last show. In particular, was here in the UK. It's in solidarity with Simon Chapman, the UK activist that's been caught and has been, in essence, framed by the Greek police, by the Greek riot police, which planted a Molotov packed full bag on him. So there was a solidarity march in London with a picket at the Greek National Tourist Office and the state-owned Olympic Airways on Conduit Street. The tourist board were actually sympathetic, and 25 people blocked the tourist office entrance for 3 hours, handing out leaflets explaining the case. And if you feel strongly about this, and if you want to get involved, there's pickets every Saturday afternoon in London at the Greek embassy.
Okay, we've got 20 seconds left, so just a quick thing to say. Listen to us next week, same day, same time. Next week we've got the Buddhist Punk, we've got the second bit of the interview with Nick and Helen. We've hopefully got an interview with John Jordan from Reclaim the Streets. We've got our friend Ruth, who's going to sing a couple of songs to you. And we might have some stuff about squatting as well. Have a good week. See you at Abbey Field and Ponderosa. Bye-bye.